The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program and podcast that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Kevin McCullough. It's great to be with you. This week, a deadly shooting leads to blame.
That's the power of the internet outrage culture. You don't want to get the people who are the most unreasonable angry, or they'll make your life miserable.
The economy remains hot.
Employers are literally running out of workers to hire. We have 7 million more jobs today across America than we have people to fill them.
We look at parents cheating to get their kids into elite universities.
Infinite gall and chutzpah are the words to describe them.
And hope for the pro-life cause.
This is likely to make history, pro-life history in the state of Kentucky.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home stations in New York City. You can hear my program each weekday afternoon from 3 to 6 on AM 570 The Mission and AM 970 The Answer. Learn more at TheBingeThinker.com and follow me on Twitter at KMC Radio. The shooting of the mosques in New Zealand shocked the world for a number of reasons. One, this is a country with very few incidents that garner worldwide attention, especially one so heinous. The killer left 50 dead and was stopped on his way to a third location with plans to kill even more. Two, the shooter live-streamed this rampage. David French, writer for The National Review and Time Magazine, discussed the evil nature of this attack while on the Ride Home with John and Kathy on WORD-FM in Pittsburgh. First, they examined the disturbing decision to live-stream the shooting.
So what accounts for this? Is this a psychological phenomenon? Is this some kind, like, do we see cultural scripts? Well, of course we see cultural scripts in other areas. You know, I could extrapolate it, but what about in other criminal areas?
Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, cultural scripts are pretty common. I mean, you know, you'll see gang members, there are cultural scripts for being a gang member, for example. There are, you know, cultural scripts in the mafia. There are cultural scripts in almost all subcultures and cultures, and there is an actual subculture of actual and potential school shooters. And one of the things that I found to be so disturbing about the New Zealand shooting was that he did something new. And when people do something new, they often create copycats. They change the cultural script. And the new thing that he did was to live stream the shooting. This is sort of the merger of his internet trolling persona with his real world violence, and he put it all together on this live stream that was immediately shared millions and millions and millions of times. And that's the thing that I said in my piece I'm so concerned about as a result of the shooting, is that he may have created a new cultural script. And in this circumstance, I'm actually kind of surprised with the prevalence of GoPro cameras and the instant access to video on demand on Twitter and Facebook and other platforms, that this hasn't happened before. And there have been people who have live streamed criminal acts before, but nothing quite like this. And so this thing, because it was so famous, because it was spread so much, because it created absolutely instant notoriety, that's what really raises the alarm for me. And it's, and so, you know, I there's a lot to be said about the shooting, about the prevalence of, for example, right wing violence, the merger of trolling with violence, and, you know, other aspects of this that are worth discussing. But I think from a enduring impact, I worry that this might be the single most important thing.
I know it's a regular occurrence in our lives now, but I cannot get over our propensity to find people to blame for disasters. I can't get over it, whether it's a natural disaster or it's an act of violence like this. People are absolutely obsessed with pointing the finger at somebody and saying it's your fault.
Well, it's the politicization of everything. So, of course, when there's a terror attack, we need to find out what kind of systems failed, how we could have prevented this. Of course, we need to look into larger cultural trends, see if there's there are, you know, underlying problems that we have the capacity to address. So, yeah, you got to investigate these things. You got to figure out what happened, what went wrong. But, you know, what we're seeing online is that process is being short-circuited almost instantaneously into confirming your priors, confirming your prior biases against your political opponents or preferring. And, you know, so, for example, if you're somebody who has been long critical of the focus on jihadism, the fact that a right-wing terrorist will committed mass murder is immediately a reason to say, hey, we don't put enough emphasis on right-wing terror. If you're somebody who has been focusing on jihadist violence, you'll take that immediate targeting of right-wing terror and say, ah, look, you know, this is a shooting that fits the media's preferred narrative, so they're going to hype it.
Right.
And it just goes on and on and on.
I mean, so having said that, it's a huge leap between mass murder in Christchurch in New Zealand to Chelsea Clinton and her supposed involvement.
That was the most ridiculously over-the-top public accusation I've seen on video. And I've seen a lot of ridiculous public accusations on video. But this one over the weekend, and for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, Chelsea Clinton had said last week that Representative Ilhan Omar had been speaking in a way that she considered anti-Semitic. And she said that there was no place for that in the Democratic Party. Somehow, a group of Palestinian college students who live here in America, or perhaps they're American college students who are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. I wasn't quite able to nail that down. Anyway, they accosted Chelsea Clinton in a public place and said that basically the New Zealand shooting was as a result of what she said to Representative Ilhan Omar, which, David, that is a really big leap.
Yeah. Oh, that was nuts. I mean, this was, you know, but this is so, you will actually see that kind of language in the fringes of Twitter. And you'll see this on campus every now and then. I mean, you know, one of the things I learned even going back to the early 90s is there are these absolutely out there campus activists. And I don't know what it is about the campus world that attracts them, but you can find them clustered at some of these universities. These people are just out there. But now, because we have, you know, Twitter and instantaneous video, these kinds of encounters can go viral. I mean, I've seen some crazy stuff in my days, but that was before Twitter and before phones and all of that. So, yeah, I mean, but the weird thing is there were a lot of people on the left who were just kind of slinking away from that and didn't want to comment on it one way or the other. And that's the power of the internet outrage cultures. You don't want to get the people who are the most unreasonable angry, or they'll make your life miserable. And one thing I can guarantee you is the allies, the person who confronted Chelsea Clinton, are not reasonable people. And they would immediately make your life miserable if you stood up for Chelsea.
The economy continues to fly as Democrats running for president find it a slippery subject to run on. It's difficult to push socialism while a capitalist society breaks records for low unemployment. Stephen Moore, chief economist for the Heritage Foundation, joined me on Kevin McCullough Radio on AM 570 The Mission and AM 970 The Answer in New York. It's an 18th record under the Trump administration, is it not?
Well, this is, you know, it's an interesting kind of contradiction in these jobs numbers, because on the one hand, we've got the lowest unemployment rate now in 50 years. We've got, you know, did you see female unemployment rate is now, I think, basically the lowest female unemployment rate ever. And the wages were up, which is a really good thing for middle class workers. And yet we didn't create many new jobs. And I think what's going on there, Kevin, is two things. The economy is slowing down a little bit, and I'll explain why that's happening in a minute. But the other thing that's happening is employers are literally running out of workers to hire. We have 7 million more jobs today across America than we have people to fill them. And so it's getting harder and harder. As we, you know, we had all these blockbuster jobs reports. Literally, the employers can't find the workers to fill the jobs.
And that's a good problem to have. Now, talk to
us about... Well, it is a pretty good problem, although it's starting to, you know, hurt the economic growth a little bit, because, you know, if we don't get more workers into the economy, then some of these factories and employers may move overseas where the workers are. So we want to keep the factories here. We got to get more workers into the labor market.
So what's the biggest challenge there, Steve? What do we do to do that?
Well, a couple things. First of all, you know, we need more immigration, legal immigration. You know, immigrants who want to come in and contribute to our economy legally, not illegally. So that's number one. And President Trump has an initiative to try to do that. Number two, we should pass work for welfare requirements that get people off of welfare and, you know, food stamps and, you know, public housing and Medicaid and get them into the workforce as a condition for getting these benefits. And that could move millions of people, you know, off of the tax rolls into actually paying taxes. And so those are the kinds of initiatives that we need to expand the labor force. By the way, there's a statistic called the U6 unemployment rate, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but that's the measure of that's what I've always called the real unemployment rate. It's the number of unemployed plus the number of people who dropped out of the workforce plus the number of people who can't find a full-time job. And as you know, that number went up considerably under Obama because so many people dropped out of the workforce. You want an amazing statistic. That number fell in this last jobs report to its lowest level in, you know, since 2000. So that, wow. You know, it's a great time to be a worker looking for a job.
Yeah, no, it is. And I love the two suggestions that you made because that's in essence what Mr. Reagan did, particularly the welfare to work initiatives. And yep. And what that would do to our economy, Stephen, would be what?
Well, it would, you know, it's a double benefit because number one, you get people off of, you know, welfare benefits, which costs taxpayers money, but you help those people. You know, it's good for people to get off welfare. Nobody wants to be on welfare.
Right.
People want to be productive. I mean, people want to get off the couch and do something. It makes you feel good about yourself, your self-worth. And so the best thing we can do for unemployed people is get them into the workforce, get them off the couch in front of the TV and get them, you know, a job and the skills that they need to do it.
Well, and you made mention of the fact that wages have increased in this last report. That means the quality of these jobs is getting better, too, does it not, Steve Moore?
It sure does. It means that there's a lot of capital investment going on in the country, and that's a very positive thing for the U.S. And it means that we're seeing, you know, when you have a tight labor market, it means that, you know, workers can bid up their wages. And that's exactly, by the way, when we did the tax cut, that's exactly what we wanted to have happen.
Meaning that there's more vertical moves for people in the workforce,
yes.
And as they get better
That's
at what
right.
they do, they can have more.
They're climbing up the economic ladder.
Yeah. We've seen improvement, Stephen, across every demographic. When it comes down to the 2020 debate that's already fairly well underway in some places, what beats a job in a discussion about a president?
It is. But look, you know, there's still 2 years to go. Now, what I'm worried about is the Fed is way too tight. They are taking the oxygen out of the economy. So the growth rate in the first quarter is only going to be about 1%. So we've fallen from 4% growth from the time before the Fed started raising interest rates to now, you know, it's, you know, 1% for this quarter. You know, the Fed has to be cutting interest rates, not raising them, put the oxygen back in the economy. We have deflation right now. Consumer prices have fallen over the last 3 months and commodity prices have fallen more. So my biggest concern is the Fed is not helping Trump. It's working against him.
Coming up, this is likely to make history, pro-life history in the state of Kentucky.
Good news when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Kevin McCullough. Parents today will do almost anything to see their children succeed in life. Problem is, defining success can be tricky. If it is all about getting into the right college, it can be downright absurd. Turns out, for many of the rich and famous, that's the end goal. Raising kids to be good people? Not so much. For weeks now, we've seen headlines on the parents who lied, cheated, and paid extraordinary sums of money to get their kids into schools for the mere purpose of bragging rights. But they are bragging no longer. John Zmirak, senior editor at The Stream, discussed the latest with Craig Roberts on KFAX AM 1100 in San Francisco.
You know, when this story first broke, I thought, well, this is kind of a non-starter. So somebody tried to rig the system to get benefits for their kids. All right, there's nothing new to that. But then you begin to realize the breadth and depth and the scope of all of this. I mean, for example, in one case, a $400,000 bribe to Yale's women's soccer coach on behalf of a student who doesn't even play soccer. I guess the word shameless is a big part of this equation, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the whole American elite, shamelessness and gall, infinite gall and chutzpah, are the words to describe them. I've got a piece at stream.org called Bribe College Admissions Officers? My parents wouldn't pay for driver's ed. which is true. I'm from New York City, and my mother considered driver's ed to be a waste of money. She said, why don't you just take the subway? There's a big difference between giving money to the college to, like, buy a building and hoping that they will let your kids, your grandkids, into the building, into the school. Between that and bribing a coach, okay? First of all, one benefits the school and provides financial aid for people like me. My dad was a doorman. I went to Yale. When I went there, my family was getting food stamps. I got to go there, virtually free because we were broke, and that was a great thing. If people want to donate to the school, I think it's fine for the school to admit legacies whose parents and grandparents went there, because it helps create kind of a heritage of people who look out for the school and they benefit from the school. T.F. Eliot praised that in his book, The Idea of a Christian Christianity and Culture. He praised the idea of hereditary elites, but they were real elites, like the Bush family. They volunteered for the military in wartime. The old money elites in America actually were kind of civic-minded, and I think it was good, and it's still good, if colleges admit legacies like that. But the new ruling class in America, the Felicity Huffmans and the Alec Baldwins, the people who make money while being leftists, who benefit from capitalism while embracing socialism, and consider themselves entitled, they want the best of both worlds. They want to act like a hereditary elite, like the old Bush family. They want to be treated like that, but they want to act like spoiled, selfish, narcissistic individualists. They want to receive privilege and pretend that they're for the underprivileged. They want to censor opposing ideas but be called liberals. They basically want to be treated like aristocrats but pretend that it's a meritocracy.
And I think this is what ultimately, at the end of the day, is really getting under the craw of so many people. This is a little bit over the top, John.
Right. Well, what it's doing is exposing that our so-called meritocracy is nothing of the kind. And it reminds me of those left-wing politicians who want forced busing in public schools. They don't want vouchers or tax credits for parochial religious schools. And they send their kids to expensive private schools. Their kids never see the inside of an ethnically diverse public school.
This is sort of a mentality of entitlement at its very worst. I mean, that's a number that typically is very politically charged, or a word, rather, that's very politically charged. And a lot of us have our own opinions when we talk about others or classes of people that tend to want to or act as if they are entitled to something. But boy, talk about this. I mean, this is not just favor to get in. This is working the system in a very deleterious fashion that at the end of the day, the very system that they criticize is the very one that they're trying to manipulate.
It's just plain corruption. And I love that the people doing it, some of them were outspoken leftists, like Felicity Huffman was bashing Donald Trump in the most brutal terms. And here she is, corrupting the educational process. I think we need to see is the emperor has no clothes. These elite schools are not, in fact, elite anymore.
So much of the abortion news of late has covered the 2020 Democratic candidates' effort to go further and further left on the issue. But significant portions of the voting public are leaning increasingly pro-life. And in some states, legislatures are taking advantage of that trend. Here's Dr. Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
Recent headlines coming from Louisville, Kentucky, quote, state to have 4 new abortion laws. Take it from me, the newspaper did not mean this to be good news, but it is good news from a pro-life position. All 4 of these laws are significantly pro-life. All 4 of them are opposed by the pro-abortion movement with all of its force. All of them are expected to be signed into law, some of them already have been, by Kentucky's pro-life governor, Republican Matt Bevin. But as the article in the Courier-Journal indicates, these are 4 new laws in one single General Assembly session, and there are more that might be passed in the final day of legislative activity coming up. Deborah Yetter reports, quote, 4 of 6 bills to ban or restrict abortion in Kentucky won final passage as the 2019 session of the Republican-controlled Kentucky General Assembly draws to a close. The 4 bills now go to Governor Matt Bevin, an anti-abortion Republican, for his signature. She goes on to tell us that 2 have already been challenged in a federal lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union as unconstitutional because she writes the measures either nearly eliminate or significantly restrict a woman's right to abortion. Now, what makes this story very interesting is not just the location here in the state of Kentucky, but the fact that we are looking at the volume of bills passed in a single legislative assembly. This is likely to make history, pro-life history in the state of Kentucky. Some of the laws cannot take immediate effect because at least one of the laws is written to provide Kentucky with a pro-life statute in the event that the Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion on demand were to be reversed or vacated by the United States Supreme Court. Now let's look at the bills in turn. The most important of them, one that has already been appealed and a federal court has put on hold, is a law that would nearly ban abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. This has to do with the so-called fetal heartbeat bill. It's a bill that would say that abortion would be illegal and the unborn life would be protected once a detectable heartbeat is existing. Now, that's really interesting because just consider how you would have to make the opposite argument. This is exactly what the pro-abortion movement is doing. They are arguing that the heartbeat is of absolutely no moral or legal significance. Now, which side of this argument would you want to be on? Let's just consider the fact that you don't know anything about abortion, but you do know something, at least, about what it means to be a human being. You know that a human being, the existence of human life, depends upon a beating heart. We know that the beating heart is a sign of life. And thus, if you're just thinking about the argument and you don't even know what abortion is, you would certainly want to be on the side of the argument that associates a beating heart with a human being. You would certainly want to be on the side of the argument that associates with the human person an entire understanding of human dignity and the sacredness of human life.
Coming up, a leader in the abortion industry discovers life.
When she had her change of heart, she came right into my office.
Her powerful story when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. The story of Abby Johnson is one of the most powerful modern transformations. She went from being a Planned Parenthood director to a pro-life activist. And her story has been made into a film in theaters at the end of this month, the title, Unplanned. The man who once was her adversary is Sean Carney, the very person she approached first when she had a change of heart. Carney spoke with Salem host Eric Metaxas.
I get to talk right now to someone who is portrayed in a feature film. The feature film is called Unplanned. You've heard about it. It's going to be releasing at the end of this month. March 29th is the release date. You have got to see this film, Unplanned. But in the film, there's a character. His name is Sean Carney, who plays a central role in this true story. But I don't have the character on the phone. I actually have the man upon whom the character is based, Sean Carney himself. Welcome to the program.
Good to be back, Eric. How are you?
Are you play acting or do you really mean that? Is that really you?
I'm pretending, of
course.
Just
being yourself? Sean, this is
exactly.
This is so cool. When I heard about the movie, now a lot of people don't know the story of the movie. So if you don't mind, tell my audience, what is the movie Unplanned that's releasing at the end of this month? What is the movie about?
It is about the beautiful conversion story of Abby Johnson, who was a Planned Parenthood Employee of the Year. And she ran the abortion facility in College Station, Texas, and I was the director of the pro-life organization there, 40 Days for Life, started in College Station, Texas. It's now in 816 cities. And so I knew Abby. We started volunteering at the same time for opposing organizations. We became directors of opposing organizations. And then when she had her change of heart, she came right into my office, and which was located next door and it tells this beautiful story of her transformation. And for us, it was beautiful. You know, Abby and I did media interviews against one another's points for years, and yet she trusted us when we said, yes, we're there for the babies, yes, we're there for the women, but we're even there for the workers who want to leave. And she took us up on it.
Well, and there are so many workers. I mean, people need to know this, that there are tons of people working at abortion clinics who are having funny thoughts about the whole thing, but they can't say anything. And if the right mm-hmm. person speaks to them in the right loving way, they're looking for a way out many times. And so you were there. What year was this that we're talking about?
I met Abby when I was 19 years old, and that was in 2002, 2003, and then she left in 2009. So the movie covers about an 8 or 9 year time period.
Okay, and who plays you in the movie?
Jared Lotz, who ironically is the only actor in the entire film that I have not met.
This is a film that needs to be made, and it was made, and now people can see it pretty soon. It's exciting.
It is, and it'll be the definitive movie on abortion. They're going to open in close to 1,000 screens. We've done the largest pre-purchase of theaters of any movie in the history of film, including The Passion and God's Not Dead. And so it's going to have a huge opening weekend, and it shows two abortions. It was given an R rating, but you can take high schoolers to see it.
Well, I want to say something about the R rating. Some friends of mine and I signed a letter based on this R rating. It is really scandalous that they gave it an R rating. It does not deserve an R rating. And I want to tell you folks, if you're afraid to bring your 14-year-old, this is nonsense. They gave it an R rating because they do not like the message of the film. And by the way, it's not even a message. It's a true story that you're going to take away a message. But it's a true story. It's a beautiful story. It's a moving story. It's a story for our time. And of course, Hollywood is so in lockstep ideologically that they're not free, just to be honest, and to give it the rating it's supposed to get. So they decide that they want to give it an R rating. That's to keep people out of the theaters. And I want to say to everybody listening, all the more reason to go into the theaters. You know, you could bring your teenagers. This is not a film that is loaded with filthy language or anything. The fact that they gave it an R rating is nonsense. It's despicable that they have done that. People need to know that R rating is meaningless, that your typical R-rated film is foul. This film is nothing like that.
So you're exactly right. It's a great point, and there's much worse things in PG-13 movies. We've been working with Chuck and Carrie, who made the movie for years, and we had been discussing a potential R rating, and they still didn't think they were going to get it, even though Hollywood hates the film. But here we are. They gave it an R rating. At best, it sends a message that abortion is R-rated, that Planned Parenthood is R-rated. But as far as content that you're seeing in the movie, it's not an R movie. And anybody with common sense will see that when it's released.
To hear the rest of that very important conversation, go to ChristianOutlook.com. While you're there, sign up for the podcast, and you'll get the best in Christian talk every day. Coming up, a man seeks to become a woman.
Nobody stopped me. Everybody just kept saying yes at every step when they should have been saying no.
The touching story of Jamie Shoup when Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Kevin McCullough. Jamie Shoup decided he no longer wanted to be a man. Like so many before and since, his decision was met with overwhelming approval and celebration from mainstream society. But deep down, Shoup, as often happens, knew this was a mistake. And he has recently told his story to warn others against this awful trend. In a world gone mad, it takes far more courage to admit a man should stay a man. I spoke with Shoup on Kevin McCullough Radio. Let's go back to 4 years ago. You wrote about a decision in the New York Times that said you had made the decision to live as a woman. Why did you do it, and what happened?
I chose to live as a woman for all the wrong reasons. I was guilty of associating sex stereotypes with being a woman. I don't know how much you know about transgenderism as far as gender dysphoria diagnoses in the DSM, But I was also one of the things with gender dysphoria is that you believe you harbor the psychological feelings of a female. And at the time, I believed that about myself. I also suffer from what's called onogatophilia, which I'm attracted to the idea of myself as a woman.
In that process, then you went on a journey that people enabled this rather significantly, because a year later you made headlines before an Oregon judge.
Yeah, that really is the tragedy of all this. Nobody stopped me. Everybody just kept saying yes at every step when they should have been saying no. And yeah, I mean, the ensuing carnage of this caused an X to be put on, excuse me, on the driver's licenses, which cost the taxpayers millions of dollars. And I feel horrible about that.
That was after you had decided to be a woman. You changed your classification and decided to be non-binary. You now say you want to live as a man, the man that you were born with, and you say in your op-ed that you were very fortunate not to have altered your body. Let's talk about how important that is. This journey can oftentimes cause people to physically mutilate themselves.
Yeah, and we have to correct a few things here. So I've never actually stopped living as a man, because you can't change your sex. And that was one of the harsh realities on this. I was led to believe that, and I began to conflate identity with actual biology, and that was a big part of the mental confusion. And all the folks who should have been telling me the truth about that never did. They just kept enabling the problem.
Let's talk about why you think they do that.
Because they've been led to believe that this is the best way to treat people like me. But I disagree, because, you know, I've had the experience and parading us around in an emperor has no clothes, you know, scenario is not helpful to us.
You say that your psyche is eternally scarred and you've got a host of health issues. I would imagine that having pumped your body full of cross-sex hormones is not a good thing. But what are some of the physical consequences of the decisions you made in the past?
My kidneys were damaged by the hormones. I've had to get through some bladder problems. And then at one point, the hormones actually landed me with two stays in the psych ward in November and December of 2017. And then another two-week stay in a rehab thing to work on my mental health, which, again, you know, cost another $30,000.
You say you've come forward now to declare that you want to live as a man. How has your announcement or your decision been received by those that had previously assisted you in going the other direction?
Well, first, we have to say there's really no such thing as living as a man. I am a man. I'm biologically male. That's unchangeable. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely folks who are attacking me for this, because I'm basically tearing apart the transgender ideology, and you know, they have a lot invested in that. But I don't fear their anger.
Let's talk a little bit about, and we've got a couple of segments to spend with you, but I really want to delve into what do you think could have been some of the other ways to handle some of the feelings and some of the longings and searching and so forth that you were going through, that people said, well, you need to go through this transgender experience. What would have been some other alternatives for you?
When the first thing they should have did with me would have been to order intensive therapy. We really needed to get to the problem of why I was doing what I was doing and what my motivations were. And nobody ever did that. The one time they did try to, I basically fired the therapist and got another one who agreed with me. So I shouldn't be able to behave like that. So, yeah, I mean, we really need to talk about my issues. Like I said, if they had asked me questions, we would have found out that I was associating, you know, sex stereotypes with actually being the other sex. They would have found out that my motivations were had a sexual component to it instead of actual gender dysphoria. Yeah, and that would have all been red flags, as well as my history of physical trauma, my history of childhood sexual abuse. But, you know, nobody explored those things. It's all been shut down because, you know, under the umbrella of what they call conversion therapy, basically nobody's allowed to ask any tough questions anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that society is going to have to address. Jamie, in your story in the Daily Signal, you write about the trauma that kind of predisposed you to this, because you are a retired sergeant first class in the U.S. Army, and you were a veteran of the Gulf War, but you went through some experiences as a child. I'm just reading from your op-ed. You said, as a child, I was sexually abused by a male relative. My parents severely beat me. At this point, I've been exposed to so much violence and had so many close calls that I don't know how to explain why I'm still alive, nor do I know how to mentally process some of the things I've seen and experienced. There's not a person that I talk to about this issue, Jamie, that doesn't at some point almost 100% of the time reveal that serious abuse, and it's almost always a combination of physical abuse and sexual abuse, has been part of their background. This really should be as much of a red flag as anything else. And we are purposefully endangering future children when we continue to ignore the roots of where it all comes from, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I mean, my history is terrible. I mean, the things that happened to me as a child were far worse than anything that happened to me in the military, actually.
Talk to me about why you think that that's the case. Why is that damage so much longer lasting and so much more potent?
But yeah, I mean, my childhood sexual abuse caused lots of problems, and you know, this stuff should have been red flags to therapists, but it wasn't.
Coming up,
these parents really don't understand what they're enabling. You know, they've been misled by medical professionals who should know better.
The remaining minutes with Jamie Shue when the Christian Outlook returns for our final segment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. The story of Jamie Shue begins in a familiar fashion, a celebration of his decision to live as a woman. But in too many cases, it ends tragically as the person finds the change is not at all what they expected. Your chromosomes still define your gender, even if you try to believe they do not. However, his case is rare in that he turned from that decision before it was too late. Here's the conclusion of my conversation with Shue. You also mentioned that you watched pornography for a long time while in the Army, but you were also married to a woman, and she wasn't supportive of the things that you were talking about. So talk to me about that stage of life.
It's kind of like my wiring is twisted up. When I see a female, I don't say, you know, wow, that's a really beautiful female, and I'm sexually attracted to that female. Instead, I say, wow, I would like to be that female, and I would like to be able to have sex as that female. So I'm attracted to the idea of myself as a woman and having sex as a woman. Yeah, and that's very much pornography driven too.
But you're not but you're not what in the classic sense would be considered purely homosexual.
No, Blanchard distinguishes two types.
Gotcha.
You have the people who are driven by homosexuality. And then people such as myself, like I'm not attracted to men's physical appearance at all. I'm only attracted to the idea of having sex with them.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I asked you a question before the break, and I just want to get your reaction to it, because it's become kind of the culture dish du jour. Parents that live in cozy suburbs that have way too much time on their hands and are fancy themselves as way too far academic, have taken to this idea that they can create laboratories by which they can conduct experiments for their kids and let their kids decide for themselves what type of gender they should express regardless of their sexual identity. And I keep those two things quite separate. Sex is determined. Gender is something that people increasingly say is mental, or something that they can imagine as something else. When I read these stories, Jamie, my heart breaks. Because I think by purposefully not letting their child know that they are a boy or a girl for sometimes up to 3 to 6 years of life, we are doing no service for a child that really needs to have as strong an understanding of who they are as early in life as possible. Given what you've experienced, what is your reaction to that trend?
Well, these parents really don't understand what they're enabling. You know, they've been misled by medical professionals who should know better. I mean, we're talking about, you know, doctors who tell these parents that, you know, it's transition or suicide. The horrible things they say to get parents to go along with these transitions is absolutely nuts.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn, I'm Calvin McCullough. Join us next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.